Hello, and welcome to On Science, the weekly podcast from the Science Desk at National Public Radio. I'm Christopher Joyce. I'm here today with Richard Harris, science correspondent.
Hi, Chris.
Good to be here with you, Richard.
Likewise.
This week, climate change legislation on the Hill. We're going to talk about the Hubble Space Telescope and what's happened with it in recent weeks. We're going to talk a little bit about Mars, too, and about a little robot that's stuck up there. And finally, we're going to talk to John Hamilton about phthalates. But first, we're going to talk to Richard Harris because this week something did happen, something unusual. Something actually got through a House committee in Congress. It's the so-called Waxman-Markey bill that regulates greenhouse gases. Richard, tell us a bit about that.
Well, this has been a long time coming, and it's not sure whether it will actually result in a law, but it was a landmark, according to many people, to actually get something out of committee that was a serious effort to deal with climate change. And it's a huge bill, but the core of the bill is this idea called cap and trade, where essentially the government sets a cap on how much carbon dioxide anyone's allowed to emit over time. They lower the cap. They make it less and less and less available. And then people can buy and sell the right to pollute, to emit carbon dioxide, essentially. It's a strategy that has worked really well for controlling acid rain. It has a lot of other issues with it regarding whether it'll actually work for climate change.
It's hugely complex. I mean, it went from, I think the original draft was 640-odd pages, and I think but the one that they finally marked up was close to 1,000 pages. And it's got a lot of, bells and whistles. Bells and whistles, you might call them, or you might call them loopholes.
Yes, there are definitely loopholes in it that could actually, according to one estimate, I talked to somebody this week who said, according to his estimate, by 2030, we could actually see more carbon dioxide coming out of U.S. smokestacks and tailpipes than we see now.
Well, how could that happen?
Well, if you have big enough loopholes, basically, you can do it. The concern is that even though this is a nice, tidy idea about being able to ratchet down the amount of carbon dioxide, lawmakers are scared to death that they will end up raising the price of energy and getting everyone really mad at them. Now, this is a very tricky issue because actually that's part of the point of cap and trade is you raise the price of dirty energy.
Yeah, no pain, no gain.
Yeah. So of course, if the bill works, you will raise the price of dirty energy. The question is how much will it cost for replacement energy and how well can you hide those costs? That's why cap and trade is one reason it's very popular and one reason it's very complicated is no one knows exactly what's happening and who's doing what to whom. And I think that makes it politically more saleable.
It may be worth noting that the loopholes are written in not to get Republican votes because they all voted against it, as I understand. I don't think there were any crossovers, but it was there. The loopholes were there to get some of the Democrats on board.
That's true. And there, we should be a little bit clear about what we mean by loopholes. There are two forms of loopholes. One is ways to make sure the price doesn't go way too high of carbon dioxide and the price of pollution doesn't go too high in doing this. And so those are loopholes that are things like you can plant forests in South America, or you can help the Chinese build a dam instead of a coal-fired power plant. And those sorts of things are supposed to be cheaper ways of achieving what on paper appear to be the same kinds of reductions, but in reality may not really be reductions at all. The other thing that we saw with this bill is that basically a lot of votes were bought. The original idea as proposed by President Obama was all of these permits to pollute would be auctioned off and anyone could buy them and then buy and sell and trade. What has happened even in this first committee process is most of them have been given away to companies and industries that would feel the biggest pinch from this. And so utilities in particular get a huge amount of these valuable credits for free.
85% of them.
A large percentage. And so there's not much left. One of the other hopes about cap and trade was you'd have enough of these of this revenue left then to help fund research into cleaner forms of energy to make those forms of energy cheaper so the transformation from dirty energy to clean energy would be easier. But there's essentially no money left or almost no money left for research and development in this to make that transition happen.
You're pretty critical of the bill, but on the other hand, I mean, what's the alternative?
The alternative could be a tax, which it would be an economically efficient way to bring down emissions, but politically incredibly unpopular. We tried a cap and trade program legislation about a year ago, and by the time that legislation was done, it was bristling with billions and billions of dollars of handouts and so on. And I think a lot of people got very nervous about it. So we seem to be heading in the same direction with this legislation. So it's not at all clear that this is going to emerge. That being said, what this does say is that there are people, powerful people in Congress, who are taking climate change seriously. They're trying to figure out a way to make a difference, to start bringing down emissions. So this may not be the magic ticket, but the point is that there's a really different feel in Congress about getting something done, and clearly there's a different feel in the Obama administration in the White House. So who knows? I mean, let's suffice it to say we will be hearing plenty about climate legislation in the coming months.
Thanks, Richard. We're also going to talk about Hubble Space Telescope.
Oh, I thought it was out of here. Okay.
No, you're not ahead of it. Not yet. We want to know more about the Hubble Space Telescope because this week they wrapped up, the astronauts were up for, I guess, a week, a little over a week, quite a few spacewalks in order to repair.
Indeed.
Or improve or finally put the final touches on or maybe put to bed the great telescope, the thing that's changed astronomy forever.
Absolutely. And it's, you know, I really want to talk a little bit about the history of this because Hubble Space Telescope was originally envisioned as a way to make the shuttle do something useful. And so they built this originally as a repairable instrument. And we've seen that has saved Hubble more than once. When it was launched way back in 1990, it actually had a defect in its mirror, basically blurred vision. The mirror was ground in the wrong shape,
which was a
huge disaster. Yes. But they were able to fix it by essentially installing eyeglasses on the Hubble back then. And they've gone back numerous times, and they've upgraded the gyros, and it's basically a brand new telescope.
It's better than ever, actually.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. It's kind of like my car. You know, it's very, very little is left of the original car.
It's probably better than your car, because they were just... But I would venture to say, and this latest upgrade is yet another sort of a new and final lease on life from Hubble. We're not going to go back again. Space shuttle will retire in about a year.
So how many more years does Hubble get to live because of this latest repair?
That's who knows. But they'll nurse it along as long as it can. It lived a lot longer than they thought, but it could be good for quite a number of years yet.
But even as it disappears, there's going to be not a replacement exactly, but there's now the whole idea of orbiting. Orbiting telescopes is no longer new. There's more out there, right?
Right. And one of the drawbacks of putting Hubble where it is that it spends half its time actually pointing right at the Earth and the other half pointing at space because the way it orbits, if you can picture this orbit, it's pointing always in the same direction. So half the time it's looking at Earth, so half its time it's useless. And not only that, it goes through being in the sunlight to being in the shade, so it gets all these temperature shocks, which also have been a stress for the telescope, obviously a manageable one. But there's a whole new approach, and people are now thinking about, let's not put telescopes that close to Earth. Let's put them a million miles away, literally. And actually, the European Space Agency just launched two brand new observatories that are going out to this weird place called L2, which is a Lagrangian point where the gravity of the Earth and the gravity of the Sun basically counteract each other. Yeah. It's almost a million miles from Earth, and these two observatories, one called Herschel and one called Planck, are going to just sit there, and they can stare at space 24 hours a day. They, you know, and enjoy this nice sweet spot, if you will, and look at infrared information. And
so this what do you call it, the Lagrange spot?
Lagrange points. There are a few of these gravitational sweet spots in the solar system, and there are five around Earth, and they are and the idea is basically the Earth's gravity and the Sun's gravity basically cancel out in that point, so you don't have to expend energy to stay where you are. Basically, you're not being pulled away by the Sun, you're not being pulled away by the Earth. Their gravity cancels out, so you can sit there and essentially burn no fuel to stay where you want to be.
But what happens if they need to be repaired?
Well, that's basically, you're probably out of luck. Although it's interesting because it takes actually very little energy to get from L2 to Earth orbit. So it's not impossible to use a little bit of the maneuvering fuel they have on board to bring them close to Earth. But by then, presumably, the space shuttle will be retired, and so there will be maybe no means of greeting them in Earth orbit.
Yeah,
but the long-term concept, I'm sorry.
The other part of the story is that, you know, now without Hubble, you know, what's the point of having the space shuttle anymore, except perhaps, I guess, to build the space station that really doesn't have...
Well, that's a whole other story. But yeah, that's true. Well, the shuttle is retiring, and that's true. It is it has outlived its usefulness, or certainly this was the most important mission from the standpoint of science to do, was to repair and to do this final upgrade of the Hubble Space Telescope. So Hubble is happy. The space shuttle has really done its sort of the crowning glory of its science mission, and we move on.
But so for the whole area of sort of off-the-planet astronomy, we're passing the baton to the Europeans then.
Well, for these two observatories, but we're also planning to put something called the James Webb Space Telescope out there, also in one of these really remote million miles from Earth locations. That's a few years down the road, but that will be essentially Hubble's replacement.
So Herschel, Planck, and Webb.
Herschel, Planck, and Webb.
Yeah. Sounds like a law firm.
Yeah, and it's interesting because Herschel and Planck are named for two incredibly famous scientists.
And Webb is former NASA director.
Is a bureaucrat, exactly. Yeah. It's the first telescope ever named for a bureaucrat.
Well, thanks, Richard. That was really interesting. I appreciate you coming up and talking to us about that.
Sure, my pleasure, Chris.
So from Hubble Space Telescopes and Lagrange points to Mars and a little robot that's called Spirit, which has been up on that alien soil now for several years, I think over 5 years, sending back images and data. But 2 weeks ago, unfortunately, its six wheels got dug into the Martian soil, and the little rover is trapped. And we're going to hear from NPR's Nell Greenfield-Boyce on what kind of efforts are being made to get Spirit moving again.
The Martian soil that's got Spirit isn't like the dirt in your backyard.
It's a light, fluffy material. It's kind of like flour. So you can't get much traction in that.
John Callis is NASA's project manager for both Spirit and its twin rover, Opportunity. He says both of the rovers have gotten embedded in the Martian dunes before.
Prior to this time, the worst embedding event for either rover was when Opportunity was caught in a dune which we nicknamed Purgatory Dune.
Opportunity eventually escaped from Purgatory.
But that was a fully functioning six-wheeled rover at that time.
This time, Spirit doesn't have six working wheels. The right front one has been broken for years. The rover has limped along by driving backwards, dragging the wheel. And now, another wheel has stopped turning.
And there's some reason to suspect that a rock may be jammed in that wheel.
It gets worse. Callis says that Spirit has dug so far down into the dirt that its little mechanical belly might be resting on some rocks.
That is a concern because, just as anyone who knows who might drive a off-road vehicle, if you get high-centered on a rock or a stump, you know that you're not getting traction on your wheels because the weight of the vehicle is now on the rock and not on the wheels where you get your traction.
Callis and his team will try to take a picture of Spirit's wheels and belly using a camera on the rover's robotic arm that's really supposed to take microscopic photos of dirt. They'll also set up a special sandbox here on Earth to simulate the mess that Spirit's in. They'll put an identical rover in the box of fake Martian soil and test possible ways of getting unstuck. All that will take weeks. Callis says his team is emotionally attached to the rovers.
You know, we talk to them each day. We interact with them. They're responsive to us. They exhibit personalities. When you discover that one of them is in trouble, then you become very worried. Much like a person would become very worried about a dear relative if they suddenly became ill or in a difficult situation.
If the Spirit rover never again gets to make tracks across Mars, that doesn't mean it's dead. Even if it's stuck forever, it could still do a little science and talk to Earth. But Spirit would no longer be a rover. Nell Greenfield-Boyce, NPR News.
Okay, well, I think a podcast from On Science and from the science unit at NPR wouldn't be complete without a visit from John Hamilton.
Great to be here.
John, you've been busy again on the subject of phthalates, which are these additives in plastic containers and plastic goods. And you've got a story now on phthalates in of all places, neonatal units.
Neonatal intensive care units. Yeah, I started looking at this because one of the things that's really tough about phthalates is that the exposures that most people get are so small it makes any effect that might be going on really hard to detect. But I was looking through some of the literature, and there is one group of people who get relatively high phthalate exposures, and it turns out to be infants in neonatal intensive care units.
Where do they get them? From what substance? Is it plastic stuff?
Yeah, I mean, the thing is that if you look at a kid in a bassinet in an ICU, they're hooked up to all these tubes. And all of those tubes are plastics softened with phthalates. And not only are they softened with phthalates, but these are tubes that go directly into the child's body. So there's a direct conduit in it. Doesn't have to go through the digestive process or anything like that.
Yeah, I remember when they talked about toys with phthalates, and they were worried because the kids would put them in their mouths. And so this is even more of that.
This is a lot more direct channel. And also, when you have all these tubes, these are very, very tiny children. And they are at a time in their life when they are when experiments on animals suggest they would be most susceptible to any effect of phthalates. Phthalates tend to work like hormones in the body. And in animals, if you expose them to phthalate levels at critical periods, including right after birth, they will develop abnormally sexually.
This sounds really bad. I mean, what did they find out about the exposure?
Well, the frustration is that the only study that's been done on these kids is a relatively small study. A group at Children's National Medical Center here in Washington managed to track down about 18 kids who a number of years ago, more than 10 years ago, had been on a type of a heart-lung machine where their entire blood volume was circulated again and again and again through these plastic tubes. Mm-hmm. And so if anybody, you know, would have had a really high exposure, these kids are the ones. So they found about 18 of them and brought them back. At this time, they were teenagers, and they examined them, and they were all normal. Mm-hmm. I mean, or, you know, there was no sign of anything that looked amiss.
And would you expect something to show up by the time they're 18?
Yes, you would. The trouble is that with such a small study, you're only going to see if there was some dramatic effect, mm-hmm. right? So what this really told them was, well, we need to do a much bigger study, and nobody has.
Well, why not?
Well, I called a guy up at Harvard to ask that exact question because he has NIH funding, and he's been working on this problem, and he said he spent the past 3 years trying to design a study of these kids that would work. And there are several problems, but one of the big ones is that to do a good study, you would have to have a control group, right? Kids who aren't exposed.
Right.
But you can't compare kids who've been in intensive care with healthy kids because there's so many other differences. By nature, they're going to have different development patterns,
right?
And so you have to find a bunch of kids who've been in intensive care but didn't get phthalate exposure, and you can't find those.
Because of the plastic tubing all has phthalates in it.
If you look at most hospitals still, there's a huge amount of phthalate exposure for these kids.
Well, I mean, is there no way that they can design an experiment so that they can get a control group of some kind?
Well, what they're going to try to do is hospitals are now actually transitioning. They're trying to bring in tubing that has less phthalates or has a coating that keeps the phthalates from coming out. And so they think that during this transition time, what they'll be able to do is find a hospital that's brought a bunch of this stuff in and look at the kids in their intensive care unit and compare them with kids in another intensive care unit. So you'd have no phthalate exposure versus some, but you'd have a difference in the amount, and you would look for differences between those two groups of kids.
That's pretty subtle. Yeah.
Hard thing to do, and it would take a lot of years because you have to wait until they're teenagers to get the results.
When they look for effects from using these tubes, what sort of effects are they looking for?
Well, the two things you would be looking for, the most obvious, would be some sort of change in the timing of puberty. You've seen this in animals. And the other thing would be effect on fertility, which is one of the reasons you have to have these very long-term studies. So you'd be looking over, really, you'd want to look at people over the next 30, 40 years. You'd want to see, do they develop sexually in any way that's different? Is it later or earlier, for that matter? And then in animals, what you see is they're less likely to have offspring. So you would want to look at these kids and see, as they became adults, did fewer of them have children?
Mm-hmm. What about, finally, what's going on with the tubes in hospitals? Are they taking the phthalates out of those?
They're trying. Hospitals have been, and especially neonatal intensive care units, where they have a history of some problems. At one time, these kids got oxygen, and it turned out to make some of them blind. So they're very sensitive to anything that they might be doing to the kids. And they have been looking for ways to remove the phthalates. There are, for instance, feeding tubes now that do not contain phthalates. But feeding tubes don't need to be as flexible as some of the other tubes, and there are still some tubes that it's very hard to make without phthalates. So what they're doing is they're using a type of tube where they can that has a coating on the inside that seems to keep the phthalates or a lot of the phthalates from leaching out of the plastic into the kids.
It just reminds me of all these situations like this that happen when you get a potential danger that you can't measure, and so you try to fix it, but do you know whether the fix is even more dangerous than your original problem?
You don't know. And the other thing is that if you're talking about a healthy child, you know, you can switch from a rubber ducky that contains one thing to a rubber ducky that contains something else. But for these kids in the hospital, these are life-saving treatments. They cannot, you know, get rid of – they have to have some kind of effective tube or these children would die.
Yeah, and a tube that doesn't work well could pose a greater risk than the phthalate itself possibly, I suppose. But
yes, if it, you got a tube that kinked or didn't work as correctly, yes, you could, in fact, endanger lives.
Well, mark this up into sort of the limits of knowledge category of, you know, you, the more you know, the less you're able to make a decision.
I'm afraid that's exactly where it leaves us.
Well, thanks, John, for talking to us about this.
Pleasure.
And that's it for this week's On Science, the podcast from the Science Desk at National Public Radio. I'm Chris Joyce. We heard from Richard Harris and John Hamilton. We heard a story from Nell Greenfield Boyce. If you'd like to send us an email and tell us what you think or what you'd like to hear, go send it to nprscience@npr.org. And we'd love to hear what you've got to say. So shoot it in and we'll do our best to keep this podcast interesting. And until next week, this is Chris Joyce for NPR.